Energy Podcast for the week of February 28th, 2010. This is Shawnee O in Central New Jersey, and today I'm joined by PB contributor Monica, who is in D.C.
Hello.
Joel, you know him as a Black Ink, and he's coming from Tampa, Florida.
Good evening.
And Jamel, who is in Charlottesville, VA.
Hello.
Okay, so as per always, we're going to talk about three things today. First up is healthcare reform, and more specifically, President Obama's bipartisan healthcare summit. Second is my piece in the American Prospect about how anti-choicers are trying to coerce women of color out of having abortions by insisting that women of color are being coerced into having abortions. And topic three is about the David Paterson bombshell we actually weren't expecting. And lastly, we're going to close with shout-outs to whatever was awesome this week. All right, so let's just jump in. Jamel, on Thursday, Barack Obama hosted a bipartisan healthcare summit, which included a mix of House and Senate Democrats and Republicans. Can you give us an overview of what happened and, more importantly, what it means?
Well, I'm not sure if I can give the most accurate overview of what happened, given that the whole thing was 7 hours long. I guess I wasn't expecting it to be that long, you know, like a couple hours and give and take. No, 7 hours. And for the most part, most of what I listened to was very boring. I think a lot of people were expecting it to be a replay of the Republican retreat when Obama sort of just took their shit all over the place. But Republicans, though crazy and occasionally malicious, aren't super dumb and understood that they couldn't go in completely unprepared or Obama would again take their shit. So this time there was actually something of a back and forth. What was frustrating, though, and what John Chait pointed out multiple times, and what Ezra Klein pointed out too, was that, you know, Democrats had come in prepared to talk substantively about their bill. Republicans came in and would say things like, you know, why can't we just all agree to, you know, do the regulations we agreed on, like covering pre-existing conditions? And the president and other Democrats would respond, you know, naturally, if you do that, you have to do these other things, which gets you back to the original bill. And you know, Republicans had nothing to say. They kept on just sort of ignoring the fact that there are implications to the suggestions they're making. They harped a lot on process and, you know, the number of pages in the bill and, you know, buzz phrases like government takeover without actually bringing, you know, ideas. I really hate the word ideas right now because all you hear is like, hey, Republican ideas, Democratic ideas, Republican ideas, whatever. It's just really annoying. But if you've been paying attention to the healthcare debate, you've heard everything that was talked about during the summit, as far as I can tell. Insofar that it was even, you know, remotely remarkable, it's in that the real divide here between Republicans and Democrats philosophically is that Democrats believe that the federal government is capable of undertaking ambitious, large-scale legislation to make a difference in the lives of Americans. And Republicans simply aren't. Republicans don't seem to believe that it's possible for the federal government to undertake successfully ambitious legislation, which is fair. But if that's what the divide is, then there's no amount of negotiation and no amount of talking that can ever bridge it, because it really is a fundamental difference. That said, I don't know if this is going to have any much of a political impact. I'm willing to bet, you know, that most Americans – even like a small minority of Americans weren't really watching this. I'm fairly certain that the only people watching this lived in D.C. And its surrounding areas.
I co-sign on that. Yeah, I don't think anybody paid attention to it, which is probably all the better for them because it wasn't very interesting. There were a few nice moments of like Dick Durbin and somebody else whose name is escaping me right now, just kind of really smacking down stupid Republican talking points, but those things were few and far between, and it was mostly just like Republicans trying to play on fears of like the government doing things badly, which lots of people who don't pay much attention to policy feel right now because they feel like the country's going to shit and don't understand the ways that, you know, the past administrations are still having an effect on the way that we deal with these problems. But yeah, no, I think the only people paying attention to it were people like me and you who blog and about these things.
So what you guys are saying is you don't think we should just start all over again, like scrap the bill and start fresh?
That's absurd. I mean,
they kept suggesting that. I mean, why not?
I mean, you know, I mean, it's so clearly a stalling tactic. If there's no way, I mean, you know, for as much as, you know, the Republicans are Lucy and the Democrats are Charlie Brown, you know, falling for the cake. I mean, none of them can really believe that the Republicans are negotiating in good faith that, well, we're going to start over and we're going to, you know, come to the table here. I saw Paul Ryan on CNN a few minutes ago because I was one of the probably, you know, people outside of the Beltway that didn't actually watch the summit today, but that's because I couldn't see the TV from my desk at work. But you know, he was summing it up, and you just get the sense that, like, there's nothing that Democrats can do to sell Republicans on this, or to get them to come to the table in good faith, because no matter what happens, and it's just a sad political reality that if they were to pass comprehensive health care reform, it would be bad for Republicans in the long run. So they can't support it, and so there's no need to even go through this rigmarole. And actually, you know, it's really funny because I was the only channel that's going on right now that I'll watch, you know, CNN, that's kind of, you know, recapping some of the events of the day. And they had Mark Halperin on there, and he said, you know, at the end of this, he said, well, the country wants compromise. And I'm just like, that's such bullshit. I don't think people care about whether or not, you know, people on Capitol Hill get along and, you know, they can get coffee together and go hang out and stuff like that. I mean, they want to get shit done. And so, like, for people to talk about, let's start over and be bipartisan and compromise and work together, who gives a shit? That's not how this works. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. I mean, first, scrapping the bill is silly. You know, Democrats have put in God knows how much time to this. Like, they've already paid most of the political costs. Might as well just, like, take it to home base. What's interesting, right, is it actually doesn't bother me that much that Republicans have no interest in negotiating or compromising. Like, that's good, you know? It's good that they disagree fervently and don't want to help or cooperate. They have an alternative philosophical vision, and that's cool. That's the way things are supposed to work. The problem isn't that Republicans don't believe or don't agree that the government should be responsible for universal coverage or any of that. The problem is that they both have the incentive and the power to cause the majority to fail. And so, you know, if you took that away, if Republicans could no longer, like, cause the majority to fail via, you know, random parliamentary procedures, then, you know, whatever. Who cares what they think?
Yeah, I was just going to say, too, I think that the argument that America wants compromise completely ignores the fact that the bill is compromised. Like, that was one Republican talking point that people kept bringing up today. Like, thank you for having this debate. I wish we had done this 9 months ago. And it's like, you did do that 9 months ago. That's why it took forever to get out of the Senate Finance Committee. It's ridiculous. But, yeah, I agree that there is good room for debate, and, you know, that's kind of just how our system is set up, is this kind of counterbalancing system that is necessarily slow for that reason, and it's completely different from European countries, and we decided that our country was going to be that way, and whenever we have an opportunity to not be that way, we tend to like counterbalance. We tend to elect Congress and Senates that are the different party from the president. You know, we just tend to not like people running away with one agenda.
Monica.
Yeah.
I hate to interrupt, but do you really think that we like it this way?
I mean, no, I was going to say, like, we, the country as a whole, tend to do that. I don't like it that way because I pay attention to things. But, like, we, you know, if it were up to proposed to change our system, I, you know, people just wouldn't do it for whatever reason. This is just like America's, this is what America does. And,
right.
You know, I would actually have preferred if, like, Bush had scrapped the Social Security system, if there had been a Congress that would have co-signed, that would have ported that agenda, and then people could have lost their entire life savings in the stock market crash, and they would have realized how good the government is at insuring people from catastrophic failure. Like, I know that sounds like awful, but like we as Americans don't feel those things because we're actually like even our poorest citizens actually relatively do somewhat well compared to the poorest countries in the world. But like, you know, I just think that like that there's we're just insulated from seeing what the federal government does for right. individual people. And that's especially true in like rural America that feels very separate from DC.
I will just go ahead and say that I don't know. I really like the pushback against this idea that Americans have somehow made a choice between a more European system and you know our system. When the founders devised our system, they were A, trying to make some hard political compromises, and B, there wasn't really many examples in existence for like a functioning democratic system. Mm-hmm. And so at this point, this is really just sort of the weight of historical inertia. It's really telling that whenever the United States write the Constitution for anyone else, we tend not to do this. We tend to have a Westminster-style parliamentary system, you know, written in for other countries, because I think we recognize on the level of abstraction that our system really isn't that great.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I think that for many Americans, the last thing they heard about government was in civics class when you hear that checks and, you know, checks and balances is a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. And American civics classes really kind of amount to like a year-long America, fuck yeah. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, I mean,
America!
Yeah, one thing we hear over and over again is, you know, America has the best healthcare system in the world.
It
and
doesn't.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's number 37.
But I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, right. But we don't know any better, right? And I mean, it's the same thing with government. We don't know any better. And so it's just like we can say, I mean, it's easy to make fun of European-style government or Western European-style government because we don't know. All we know is that America is a really wealthy country. And like Monica said, you know, even our poorest citizens have a standard of living that is, you know, exceeds, you know, people in other poorer countries like Somalia or Haiti, for instance. So we don't know. But I mean, I'm not willing to, you know, let us be bombed out and depleted and, you know, let our system go to shit, you know, to prove that Republican ideals are, you know, I mean, obviously I'm slightly partisan in this, but that conservative ideals, you know, would really put us in danger if, you know, implemented fully, you know. But I mean, there's got to be something. I don't know what it will take, you know, for people to understand that, like, you know, some of these ideas are really stupid. You know, some people are not coming to the table in faith. I mean, like, well, for instance, today I didn't see the summit, but like, where's somebody like Bart Stupak? Was he there at the summit today?
No, Bart Stupak had better things to do. He had to go make sure women weren't getting abortions or something.
Yeah, right.
He was on the hunt.
That's not for the birth abortion clinic, right? I mean, are Ben Nelson or Mary Landra? Like, where were these people? You know, today they weren't. Were they not invited? I guess what was the issue, or were they not invited, or did they not come because, you know, they didn't feel the need to be there?
I don't know.
I
would say, like, as for the question of why is it that, you know, representatives use this rhetoric that's like repeal Social Security, get rid of regulations. I think part of it is a product of institutional sort of gridlock. When you know, as a matter of course, that you won't be able to implement most of your agenda because of Congress or whatever, why not make outrageous claims? Like, no one's ever really going to call you on it. And part of the reason why I would like to see the filibuster eliminated or like reduced or whatever is that once you have fewer barriers to actually pursuing an agenda, what you say begins to matter a lot more. Mm-hmm. And I think you'd actually have Republicans and Democrats making fewer broad claims because they know now that they have no excuse not to pursue their agenda, that there isn't really anything stopping them from you know, repealing Social Security or giving the public a super strong public option, you know?
Right. No, that makes total sense. Okay, but we got to move on to our next topic. All right, so...
Yeah, let's get the Shani's article as fast as possible.
Let's do it.
So this is a bit of shameless self-promotion of a piece that I wrote for the American Prospect. And it's called Black Women Don't Need Billboards. And thanks to Monica for the title. So, okay, there are two issues that I'm addressing in the piece. One, it's that an anti-choice group, the Radiant Foundation, is putting up dozens of billboards in Atlanta. It's insisting that black children are an endangered species. And they're not alone. I mean, if you just do a Google search for eugenics and Margaret Sanger, you'll pull up tons of sites dedicated to denouncing Planned Parenthood as part of some nefarious genocidal plot against blacks. And then second, there's this new bill in the Georgia House called the Prenatal Discrimination Act. And its stated purpose is to prevent abortions based on race or sex of the fetus, but its actual purpose is to force legal abortion providers to prove that they didn't coerce black women into having an abortion. So, obviously, this is problematic, but it relies on the idea that black women are completely without a will of their own, basically that they're being manipulated into having abortions and that they need people to come in and tell them the truth and save them. It's really, really frustrating because it strips black women of their autonomy. And I said this in the article, but there's no reason to think that black women have abortions for reasons that are different than other women. The top two reasons given are a lack of support from a partner and because women just can't afford to raise a child. And as for the genocide claims, a friend of a friend of Post-Bougie did a statistical breakdown that reveals that not only women who already have children are more likely to have an abortion, but that black women actually have more children than are needed to replace two parents. So there's no sign that this so-called genocidal plot is even working because the black share of the population is projected to increase. And I also noted that a big problem is the lack of outreach to the women who are most likely to have unplanned pregnancies and, by extension, abortion. So my question is, did you guys, aside from Monica, actually read the piece?
Yeah,
this
you asked.
This is what Shawnee wanted to talk about.
What'd you guys think?
I will be honest. I skimmed through the piece, and I thought, you know, I remember someone had on Buzz, like a trendy we are, we share on Google Buzz, had shared something that was like a billboard of, you know, I think of the title. And I remember thinking, like, I was really outraged, but I wasn't really sure how to respond to that outrage. So this was really helpful in that you provide, like, facts and figures and a very good argument for why my outrage is justified. And when anyone can justify my outrage,
yeah.
Gee, thanks, Jamel. Really.
Well, this kind of to me, this goes back when you talked about like denying black women their agency. It kind of goes back to like, you know, this talking point of like acting like, you know, black people are like a different species of being. You know, like we're
yeah,
just
that's
so
what the billboard. Oh, sorry.
No. Go ahead, Monica. I'm sorry.
That's what the billboard said too. That we didn't really attack. That's really awful. But it says black children are an endangered species, and it's like, could you get any more offensive?
Right. And it's just, you know, it's just, it's really insulting and it's really condescending. You know, you say, you poor black women, you don't know what's good for you. Here, let me tell you what's good for you, and it's not having abortion. Right.
Right.
I mean, it's. I don't know. I mean, it's so disingenuous, and I you know, I guess like I don't have the same outrage because I'm really slow to anger. But I guess I'm used to this. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just feel like I'm used to this. Like, this is it was building towards this billboard, and here it is, boom. You know, so I mean, but it was a great piece. You know, you did.
That's all I wanted to hear. You could have left the rest of it off.
Yeah. Right.
No, totally. It's just, I mean, on one hand, like, I find it really hard to believe that these people actually care about the well-being of black people in general, because they're not, I mean, if you really cared about the well-being of black people, you would work on programs that help black women who already have children support those children. You would, you know, fight to end policies that structural inequity for poor black people. But these people are, you know, basically saying, don't have an abortion, and then what? You know, like, what happens next?
Right.
I think that's true of the broader anti-choice movement as well. I mean, that it's like it's pretending to care about life and babies, but what it's really doing, if it really cared about life and babies, it would make motherhood less financially devastating for mothers, and it would worry about the kinds of lives that children living have. But instead, it's really about regulating the sexual morality of women, right? You know, it's like, oh, well, if you got pregnant, you kind of, you deserve what you get.
Agreed. You know, one of the reasons why I don't hate Ross Douthat so much, and I don't hate him at all, he's actually a really reasonable guy. But
wait, when,
when it comes to choice, right? Ross Douthat, anti-choice. But I think he also makes the defensible, takes a defensible step of saying, okay, so what happens after children are born? And he supports, you know, a stronger social safety net for children. He supports, you know, like more tax breaks for parents and whatnot, things that would actually help improve the material life of the children who, you know, I guess, I don't know how you formulate this, children most likely to, that would have been aborted or whatever. So, but I mean, I agree. The broader anti-choice movement, they rail against abortion, and then they rail against, you know, anything that would mitigate abortions, whether it be contraception, whether it be, you know, sending a government-provided nurse to households to see if they need help with anything, right. You know, everything you could do to reduce abortion, they're opposed to.
Yeah,
which is why I think, you know, I appreciate the conservatives in Utah. I think who are like, let's just criminalize women.
Basically, let's criminalize. Yeah, because they just had that bill. They just passed that law that would basically criminalize miscarriage.
Right, and since 20% of pregnancies end in miscarriage, and because the bill is like, you know, if you're being negligible or deliberately, you know, harming yourself or whatever, it really just amounts to the Utah legislature saying, let's just outlaw women. And that's terrible, right? But on a very kind of an abstract level, I can appreciate that they're honest with themselves. They don't really care about protecting children. They just want to stick it to the bitches.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. That's, yeah. Okay, so here's one thing that I always wonder about, and I probably should just, like, talk to an anti-choicer, although that would probably, like, make me want to shoot myself. But, why do they want more children in the world that aren't that either are coming into, you know, households where, that can't support them, that don't want them? What, like, what's the benefit of that? I mean, because you could have, you know, another Einstein or something. I mean,
Tim Tebow, you know,
exactly.
Because you can have your own little Heisman Trophy.
Tim Tebow is the pinnacle of mankind. You got to get more.
Right.
I think it's like, well, partly it's like children are from God, you know, so you can't do that. But also you can't, you know, you can't deny that all children are formed by God in the womb. So there's no such thing as an unplanned pregnancy then. But also it's just about, you know, like poor, you know, it fits into the thing. It's like if somebody's poor and they're unable to raise their children, it's like it's their fault. It's because they're already bad people. They were born already not in the grace of God. You know, it's like that old puritanical idea that it's all predetermined, right? So it kind of doesn't matter to them, I think, whether they, as someone who is like steeped in the world in which pro-life was taken for granted. Like, the real conditions of people living on Earth is not what they spend their time thinking about.
I think it's useful to sort of like subdivide the whole movement, right? For you have those people. You have people who there's a strong degree of sentimentalism involved. You know, oh, babies, I want to protect them. Abortion kills babies. Let's stop it, kind of thing. And then I'd say you have people who are sort of genuinely malevolent, right? And understand what the implications of no abortion are and just don't care. who have thought consciously or like are aware of like their desire to control women and are just like, let's go for it.
Yeah, I also find this. I'm sorry.
Oh no, I just said yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think it's sort of ironic because I there was a piece in Mother Jones maybe a year ago, and it focused on Georgia for, about how they were encouraging women that were on welfare. They were trying to find ways to deny them benefits. Like they were really touting, oh, we've cut our welfare rolls by this much, and you know we're not spending this much on welfare. And it would ended up happening is that it ended up affecting a lot of very poor black women. And it's so, you know, I too often these groups of people seem to meld, you know, the people that want people to have babies and then the people that would like to deny any sort of safety net or social services to the women that have these babies, you know, for whatever reason, you know? So I just thought that was sort of ironic that, you know, Georgia seems to be as much of a, you know, grease fire as Texas, for instance, but you never know.
Right. Well, you know, what was fascinating about Georgia with the numbers, which were particularly kind of shocking to me when I was researching the piece, is that, you know, only 30% of Georgians are black women, but they represent 58% of all abortions. It's a huge number. So I can see why it's a dire situation, but the problem is not abortions. The problem is unplanned pregnancy. Mm-hmm. But anyway, all right, I guess we'll wrap it up here. Thanks for reading.
You're welcome.
Thanks for writing.
Yeah, thanks for writing.
Anytime. Anytime. All right. Topic number three. All right, David Paterson and the story we were all sort of waiting for, but not really, because we didn't think it was actually a story. Anyway, Monica, what's the deal?
Yeah, so Shawnee's alluding to the fact that we were all waiting for it because everyone in the journalism world had been hearing rumors about a big bombshell of a story accusing David Paterson of something horrible that would cause him to resign. And what it finally turned out to be was actually pretty horrible. And this was following a couple of other stories that didn't seem to be so bombshelly over the past couple of weeks. But the real bombshell was that one of his senior aides was accused of abusing a woman and was awaiting her case to go through the court process. And during that time, state police, who had no jurisdiction over the case, visited her, and she had a phone conversation with the governor, although there's some dispute over who called who. And she ultimately dropped the case, and it really seems that there was pressure from the governor's office to drop the case against this aide. And in that time, the aide has been suspended. David Johnson is the name of the aide, and he's been suspended. And also, I think today the head of the state police resigned because all of this had gone on. So I think it's undeniably damning for Governor Paterson. He was already pretty unlikely, I think, to win re-election, but now it looks like he won't even really run. I think today he said that he wasn't planning on dropping out, but he admitted he was going to consult some allies about his race. So I think that's the first step in him withdrawing.
Now, didn't he say he was opening up an investigation?
Yeah, and he referred Andrew Cuomo, he referred it to the state attorney, who is Andrew Cuomo, who's his biggest rival for the Democratic nomination for governor. So that's interesting. Right. You know, it could be that after the investigation, no matter what the result, Paterson can say it's political. It could be a kind of a smart move on his part, but I don't see how any I don't see how anything can save him now.
Oh, damn.
He's hopeless.
That's fine. No? I guess the question is: does anybody think that he should step down, or either? A, should he step down? B, should he get out of the race?
I think everyone thinks that. I haven't been paying a ton of attention to the commentary on it, but, you know, I think that was kind of one of the first things you heard, where people who even normally would be his allies in the state, were kind of like, maybe he should think about stepping down. It's bad for state Democrats. It's bad for New York State. The place can't avoid political scandal in its governor's office. So it's time that they start trying to avoid it by keeping people already embroiled in scandals from getting back there.
You know, here's the thing, though. I hear that argument, and then I think he should stay. I mean, I don't know about the race. I mean, because the issue then is like, is it worth the effort, you know, expending all that effort and the money that it would take to mount a challenge? And he probably won't win anyway. But as far as stepping down, like, I mean, I wouldn't see the point, because, I mean, you know, you see this over and over again. You know, oftentimes you'll see, you know, for instance, Mark Sanford, John Ensign, David Vitter, you know, guys who go through like really scandals you would think that would end their political career, and they hunker down and they wait it out, and then they're on the other side.
But what Patterson did was really bad, like worse than Sanford and Ensign.
Well, yeah, but it's still a political scandal, though. You know what I mean? I mean, I guess it's bad, but I mean, it doesn't mean it doesn't mean that he has to step down. You know what I mean? I mean, I guess what you'd have to sell me on what would he benefit from stepping down, I guess.
Well, I guess he wouldn't benefit at all.
But we would. Well, I wouldn't, because I don't even live in New York, but still.
Yeah, right.
I think, well, for starters, the governor's race is 2010, so, you know, even if he steps down, it's not that much time before there's an elected official in place there. I think what really is – what makes this scandal different, and I think what really makes people uncomfortable with him staying, is that if true, he really abused his power in that office. Mm-hmm. If he exerted pressure, however subtle, for a woman to drop a domestic violence allegation in the court system, then that's really using the power of his office in ways that are really bad. And so I think that's what's different. I mean, I don't really care if he has affairs. He probably does. He's admitted to it.
Right.
So, like, right. That's just a different order of scandal.
Yeah, I think intimidating a woman into dropping a case, like, that really disturbed me when I heard that.
Well, okay, well, now, and maybe I got this wrong. Now, they've confirmed that they had a conversation. Do we know the context of the conversation yet? Do we know, you know, like, from what I understand, he's not supposed to call this woman regardless. They're not supposed to have a conversation, but supposedly, did he say something like, if you need me, I'm here? Was it something, am I hearing that right? Was that what the report said?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's what I heard as well. But I also think that it kind of doesn't matter, the conversation, because, you know, I don't think a governor is so stupid that he's ever going to call and say, I think you should drop this case. But what I think it is the kind of, like, you know, that almost actually makes it worse, because it just means that he knows how to try to influence people subtly enough that he doesn't get immediately caught. You know, just a governor calling a woman who's made an allegation against his top aide is just inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And the woman has said there was just a general sense of intimidation. If that weren't true, then maybe it's okay that they just call and have a completely innocuous conversation. But in the context of the kind of pressure she was facing, and also just in the context of how hard it is to pursue domestic violence
allegations. Absolutely. The burden of proof is always on the woman, and it's just so difficult for her to prove it. So, you know, it doesn't really matter what he said. It's, you know, his presence was exerting influence on her.
Yeah, I mean, the presence of the alleged abuser is exerting influence on her just because he's around, because, you know, that he's a threatening presence. And so overcoming that, I think, is just really hard. And for a governor to participate in that kind of abuse of his office, I think, is really hard for people to take. It also, in the context of New York, comes right after a Queens representative was ejected from the Senate for hitting his girlfriend with a broken bottle and cutting her face.
Yeah.
He was convicted of misdemeanor assault. And so the state Senate voted to eject him. But, you know, you just kind of can't tolerate that from the people who make the laws. And so I think in the context of everything that's gone on in New York, it makes it that much worse as well.
No, yeah, I guess the thing, I'm not really disputing that it's a very serious issue, but I guess what I'm saying, though, from David Patterson's perspective, he really has nothing to gain by stepping down. This is his last rodeo in public office, I imagine. I can't see any circumstance. You know, certain people you say, well, you know, if they go through these steps or they come back or yada yada, maybe they can resurrect their political career. I don't think people took him seriously in the first place. And like now, you know, this just seals it. You know, you're just putting the nails in that coffin. So, I mean, for him, I don't see, you know, I know that there's pressure for him to get out, and probably the state Democrats would just love to have him offer their hands. But for him, I mean, you know, he might as well ride it out, you know. But to the point of what you guys were saying, yeah, I mean, obviously it's awful. Like, you're not, I mean, it's something so, not only is it bad, it's stupid, you know. I mean, you would just think, we have these expectations of our public servants that, like, they're really smart people. And,
really?
You know, yeah, I mean, I guess
nobody has that impression.
Not anymore.
No.
I've decided that they're all insane, actually.
I'm saying when I grew up, I guess, when I thought that, like, you got to be governor, like, you know, that's like a big deal, right? Like, that's something, these are supposed to be, like, some of the elite citizens in your state, in your city, in your country, whatever. And for a guy to do something like just, you know, base stupid, you know, it's just really dumb. Like, it's just, it's.
Forgotten Blagojevich?
Yeah, I know what I'm saying. I don't feel that way anymore. I guess I'm talking about more of my 14-year-old sense that, like, man, you just think, man, it'd be really hard to be governor because you'd have to be really smart and, you know, you'd have to, you know, be good in school and, you know, be really upstanding, not have anything in your closet, you know what I'm saying? And then, you know, then you get to be governor. And, you know, but you think the only difference between these guys is maybe policy differences, not the fact that, like, they're flaming dumbasses. You know what I mean?
I mean, like, it's not even like that they're dumb, right? It's that they're just flaming narcissists that they don't think the rules apply to them, which probably is like the same side of – it's two sides of the same coin. That same narcissism which drives them to higher office is often the same thing that consumes them.
Mm-hmm. I want to make really one last point about how I think this is a big win for journalism too. I think part of the reason – there was this hype for so long about a story that was going to be a big bombshell. And I also suspect, though I absolutely do not know, I had heard rumors that the bombshell was going to include some sort of accusation with state police. So every time there was a story coming out that didn't involve state police, I was really confused. But what I wonder happened was whether the reporters involved knew about this, but they just couldn't get it solid enough to publish. And so then they published those little, like, ancillary scandal-y stories, and that kind of flushed people out of the woodwork more so that they could have a more solid case for this story. I don't know if that's true, but you know, it could be. But whatever it was, they really knew something was going on in the governor's office, and they were
I was gonna say the flypaper theory of journalism. You know, you remember during the run-up to the Iraq war, it's like, if we invade Iraq, all the terrorists will come here, we can stomp them with, you know, a single swatter. It's the same principle. Yeah, you drop hints that you know something's up, and yeah, you know, there's a big scandal, and then they panic and they all flock to the same place. And you get them with a swift blow.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what happened here. You know, and I think it's – so I think it's just also a really big win for newspapers. So I'm happy for that.
Yeah, it would be great if this has happened to someplace like the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You know what I mean? But, I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously it's great that there's New York Times. But, you know, I know the New York Times is going through tough times. But, man, I mean, they've got the resources that, you know, you just – They do such a good job that sometimes you kind of overlook, you know, the fact that for all the criticisms that people make of the mainstream media, the New York Times is a really good newspaper. And I mean, this is the kind of thing. These are the sorts of stories that fly under the radar. You know, when you talk about, you know, there's so many people want to cover federal government and things like that, but it's like state government and municipal government that really, really matter and on the quality of people's lives. And you've got to have people that are watchdogs at those levels, you know. And it's just, you know, echoing what Monica said, I mean, it's really good to see, you know, something like that. I guess, you know, David Patterson's not doing his best to make it easy on them, too. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boom.
All right.
Yeah, that's just yeah.
Done.
That was so interesting and awesome.
So. All right. Okay, well, let's move on to lists. Shoutouts. Yeah.
We should have like something else in between this and shoutouts. Like we can make up a sponsor, you know.
Okay, we should we could totally record like a fake sponsor commercial, like a Prairie Home Companion or something.
Yeah, I'm thinking about making a dating advice book for Black women.
Oh God, no! Joel, tell me what the answer is. Why am I single?
Yeah, I mean, really, your standards are much too high. You need to date a shithead, you know?
A white shithead.
Exactly.
A white
shithead. Clearly.
Forget love, man. What's that?
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm going to die alone.
These articles are literally written, like, once every 2 months. I don't know how that works. Right. Part of me thinks, right, that there's, like, the platonic ideal of one of these articles existing in the ether, and, like, it just, you know, collective unconscious for, like, you know, dozens of writers just pops into their head and they hear this complete app. And their editors are like, I haven't heard this idea before. And they publish it.
I don't understand how the Washington Post thought. Well, I do, because the Washington Post. Anyway. But. The Washington Post is awesome. But. It just, like, what? Like, and clearly. Yeah, I couldn't even get past the first page, really. I was just like, make it stop. I can't take any more of this.
I mean, there's just so much wrong with them. From, like, you know, there's the one observation that, hey, people in general don't date interracially very much. Like,
exactly! That was my main point. Right. Most people don't date interracially, so why should Black women be the exception? Because otherwise we're going to die alone.
And then beyond that, it's like, if you're really curious as to why, you know, rates of interracial dating among Black women are lower than the rates of interracial dating among, like, other demographics, you really have to look at, you know, population distributions. Like, where are Black women disproportionately concentrated? Well, they're concentrated mostly around other Black people.
Mm-hmm. Other Black women, shoot.
Other Black women. So, yeah, right. Because you're most likely to date the people that you're closest to geographically and socially, chances are you're not going to see very much interracial dating with Black women, because geographically they're closer to Black men, and socially they are too.
And well, yet, and still Black men, still vast majority of Black men still date Black women.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's just like this whole, like, yeah, this hand-wringing over how it is that people get married when everybody really knows how it is, and it's like that you just meet people in your daily lives that you come across, as opposed to some sort of population plan. People aren't sitting around going
maybe you should move to Detroit, right?
Yeah, totally. It's not like, you know, it doesn't work. There's no like secret to your success of marriage, you know. It is what it is. Anyway,
I'm not sure. I hear if you roll like a 12 on a 12 set of die, that's instant marriage.
All right. Well.
Well, you know what my plan is, right? I think we should, like, somebody should hire Bobby Brown to go out and date like all the Black women in America.
So that what? They can all end up like Whitney? Come on.
Yeah, I'm just saying. Because Bobby Brown will date anybody.
And
you know what I mean?
Their lives. And people don't
stay on your house. You know,
can he wear the suspenders he wrote in Every Little Step?
Oh my God.
I saw that video again the other day and I was like, I totally forgot he wore spandex and suspenders. That was his outfit.
Yeah, and the Gumby. And he had the Gumby too, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Bobby Brown. Thank you. I'd rather die alone.
Okay. I hope Bobby Brown hears that. I hope he hears our podcast. And he hears Shawnee O'Hilton say, I'd rather die alone than date. How do you think that makes him feel, Shawnee?
Also, you don't know Bobby Brown. He could be a completely charming partner.
Have you seen that show, Being Bobby Brown?
Oh, no.
Okay. No. Go to YouTube.
Okay. He's on Celebrity Fit Club now, if you're interested. So,
if we want like to see the new Bobby Brown,
yeah, I'm saying he's working through his troubles now. So.
I just want, if he writes a book on Black relationships, I'm gonna be done, because between Steve Harvey and Hill Harper and every other random dude who basically is telling us how to date them.
Right.
if you wanna get like dated, what you gotta do is you gotta listen to post punk and some synth pop. You gotta play Dungeons and Dragons and get into 64.
The other thing, okay, here's the other thing before we move on. Okay, here's the other thing before we move on is that, like, these articles make it sound like there's this line of white guys, like, outside my apartment waiting for me to just notice them. It's like, no, they're not there. So it's not like black women are, like shutting themselves off to these multiple possibilities of sexy white men who look like Simon Baker. You know, it's like, come on, let's be realistic here.
Yeah, well, I thought it was really interesting, that story, like, the story of that author and her getting together with her husband was just like, it just sounded depressing to me. And then, the writing of the story, too, it's like, they looked at each other across the room and smiled. It was, you know, something like, it was easy to tell that maybe they were attracted to each other. It was just like, I don't know, it's like, what the hell, they're not like, you know, like a dog and a cheetah, you know what I mean? They're still, they're married. Of course, they're, you would think they would be attracted to each other. They were just making it just like we're not two human beings.
It's like, yeah, you can always hear the Discovery Channel narrator in these stories. Yeah. And then he approached the
female. But if he brings her a drink, it's strange
amongst
these people.
No, I skipped ahead to the end, and the depressing part was like the woman who was like not attracted to the guy, but they just kept going out because she didn't have any of their options, and then they ended up together, and it was just like, what?
I mean, I think it's also tough to acknowledge that kind of happens to a lot of people.
It
you
does.
Know?
That it does, but it's not like a special, like, this is what you should try. Okay, so even if you don't find them attractive, just give it a shot.
Yeah, because, like, you know, otherwise you'll die alone.
Right. Yeah. That was the thing. She's like, well, she considered, something seemed like she considered the alternative and was like, she'll stay with him.
Really shitty guy. Or I could not.
Yeah, it's that whole settling for Mr. Wrong idea.
Oh,
yeah.
Who could read that, like, about, like, your like, wife, like, saying, you know, when we first met, I wasn't really attracted to him, you know, he didn't have the skin color that I liked. And, I mean, she really said that. She's like, he's really pale and had red hair. And I'm just,
he's really pale and had red hair.
I was like, are you serious? Don't tell anybody that in public, man. Even if you feel that way.
I mean, that would even be understandable, right? Like, you know, you're like, I met him, and, like, he was sort of like goofy looking, and I grew to love him. Ha ha ha, cute. But this is more like, I met him, and I thought he was goofy looking, and that hasn't changed.
Yeah.
He wore me down.
Okay. Right. I am surrendered.
But I don't want to be alone.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm going to have a goofy looking husband and some goofy looking kids.
Right.
Because everybody knows all you want is to be married and have children.
It's all I want, Shawnee.
I know. And be in the
kitchen.
Gotta
pop them out.
Time.
Pop, pop, pop.
Yeah, right.
And be in the kitchen and cook.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's the American dream. There you go.
Yeah.
Totally. All right. Well, I guess this is our mini, our fourth topic. I don't know. All right, so let's go around and do our shout outs. Jamal, go for it. What are you shouting out or shouting down this week? Because I know that's your, like, you like to shout things down instead.
Shout down, because I'm so full of rage. No, my shout out this week goes to a wonderful program called Steam. For those of you who aren't nerds and have friends, Steam is a program, I think, put out by Valve, which lets you purchase and download video games, and they have a really wide selection. And lately, I've just been jonesing for, you know, computer gaming time. So I've and they usually have sales, like $10, $15 for a game. So it's been a really neat way for me to, you know, do something that's not reading or writing, play video games, and do it cheaply and quickly. There's been a lot of talk about Mass Effect 2 lately, and I haven't played the first Mass Effect. So I recently bought Mass Effect off of Steam, and it's dominated my life because it's so awesome.
All right.
Ladies, I'm also free, you know.
All right. Monica.
You know, I am going to actually like shout down any more talk about the healthcare bills. I don't care anymore. I don't like, you know, the Kaiser Foundation and all these other useful organizations are putting up like side by side comparisons of the bills, and it's like, we should already all know this by now. Like, the people who don't know clearly do not care. They just want to believe the talking points and side with whatever party they think expressed their interests, because if they did pay attention, they would already know that it's like time to pass the damn bill, which I think is what a lot of people actually feel right now, is that, you know, we're just ready to get on with it. So I would be happy if for the next time we talk about healthcare should be after everybody already has healthcare and we're talking about how to pay for it and people realize they don't want to lose the care they have and they like admit that they want their taxes raised to cover it.
All right. It sounds good to me. All right, Joel.
I've actually got a couple things. I'd like to shout down. I just discovered this today, and I'm really disturbed, and I would like it to stop before it gets started. my favorite hip hop artist, Jay Electronica, is dating Erykah Badu.
What?
Wait. This has been going on. He's the father of her child.
Oh my God, are you serious?
This has been going on for like 2 years.
Wait, are you serious?
I'm dead serious. He is the father of her. Yes, they have been going out for like 2 years, son.
Oh my God.
You really? Haven't seen the effects yet. He hasn't started wearing like
he's not.
Yeah, done. like a pocket tan and like suspenders and like a fur hat.
You know how I feel about people hating on Erykah. She has the best. She brings out the best in Edward. And even if it's common, it's not her fault that the best in common was pretty bad.
Oh my gosh. You know what? Gotta stop.
No, that's just, yes. B is a good album.
Yes, thanks to Kanye West Beats.
That's right.
True.
Look, no, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Though. Resurrection, I mean, like, if you listen to some of his earlier stuff, it was not that bad. He was a really good artist. He just didn't have the production that some of the other guys had. He's a really talented artist. Now, you know, I think I said, Shani, it's just you're still holding on to that.
No, it's if you look back, we've already had this conversation. Don't make me start breaking out old school common lyrics. Back when he was Common Sense saying misogynistic shit, just like, yes.
All right. I shouldn't have even gone there. But no. Anyway, the other thing is, if you haven't heard the Al Sharpton Tavis Smiley showdown, you really should. I mean, it's really interesting. And I know that people, and I mentioned this earlier this week, that I know it's really easy for people to, like, you know, make a caricature of Al Sharpton. I know a lot of people, you know, at least they used to talk about his hair and his size, and, you know, he's kind of an excitable guy, and he's a really polarizing figure in American history. But, I mean, the guy's really sharp. He's a really smart guy, and he's passionate about really important things. And I'll just never forget when he you know, ran in the Democratic primaries, I guess it was, 2000 or 2004. And I just remember thinking, I was like, man, it just like kind of snuck up on me. I was like, you know, why do people make fun of Al Sharpton so much? I was like, he's a really gifted dude. And I mean, there was no chance in hell that he was going to, you know, win the primary, but I just, whatever. And I have my thoughts about Tavis Smiley. I won't share them here, but, you know, needless to say, I think Al Sharpton, gave him an official Peter roll. That's what we call it.
Okay.
You know, so there you go.
All right. Fair enough. Okay. So it's funny that we were talking about the Washington Post article, because that was going to be my shout down. But I have a shout out anyway. Okay. We're breaking the rules here. It's only supposed to be one, but whatever. All right. So my shout out this week is to Greyhound adoption. And so the main reason we didn't have a podcast 2 weeks ago is because I was out looking for my missing greyhound, Scarlet. Greyhounds, when they get off leash, and she got scared and pulled the leash off my hand, they get off leash, they just take off at like up to 45 miles per hour. That's how fast they can run within seconds. And literally within seconds, she was out of sight. And she actually took off like the day before we had a major snowstorm, and it was just really traumatic and horrible. But the awesome thing about greyhound adoption is that when you adopt your greyhound, you also get a whole set of crazy greyhound people who love greyhounds too. And so they had people coming up from like an hour away to put up flyers and help me look for her. And within 3 days, we found her. And she was out in the storm. She lost some weight. She got hit by a skunk, but other than that, she's fine. And greyhounds, if you want a dog and you want a, and you need a dog that can kind of do long hours by itself and doesn't really mind you, you would want a greyhound because there's this myth that they're like super high energy. But I'm looking at mine right now and she's passed out, and this is her normal state of being. She sleeps probably 18 hours a day. She only bothers me when she like is hungry or wants to play a little bit. But anyway, and luckily GD came out and helped look for her, and we were able to find her. So greyhound adoption, it rocks. Other than the whole you can never ever ever let them off the leash ever.
Yeah.
She's probably still dreaming about her little doggy adventure.
I know.
Like homeward bound.
the first couple nights she was like making noises in her sleep, and I was like, what are you thinking about? But I'm sure to her that was like, 30 minutes of her life, and now she's back to normal, whereas I was like terrified. But anyway, that's my shout out. All
Good
right.
for Scarlet.
Yay, Scarlet.
That's right.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's podcast. On behalf of Jamel, Joel, and Monica, this is Shawnee O, and I would like to thank you all for listening. We will catch you next time.
Our theme music is 8 by Aeon. You can catch us at postbougie.com.